The third, although hit, turned without stopping, exposing its flank to our anti-tank machine guns, which ripped off all its protruding guns. It continued in a circle broken by a series of banking turns, trying to execute a half turn. This dramatic attempt left us gasping with admiration. In his will to survive, the Russian driver headed straight for our minefield. A series of explosions ripped the tracks off his left side, and the tank slowly settled, like a vanquished beast. As the thick black smoke began to pour from its entrails, two dark figures climbed out. But our cold stiffened fingers did not fire. Both Russians were holding their pistols, prepared to defend themselves. When they didn't hear any guns, they took a few steps toward our lines, then threw down their guns and raised their hands. A moment later, they were crossing our front line. The Lancer, who considered them heroes, grinned, and the Russians grinned back, their teeth gleaming very white, like Negro's teeth, in their smoke-blackened faces. Our men took them to an izbu and gave them some schnapps. Their attitude and performance seemed so far removed from those of the partisans that we felt no hate for them. Lenson watched them for a moment and said, "If we know we're here, he'd probably drink a toast with them." During the following night, we sent out patrols to relay the minefield. Our defensive fighting was relying increasingly on mines to take the place of weakened or missing lines. The next day there was a general reinforcement of the front. Two Romanian regiments and a Hungarian battalion were sent to join us. We were told that we would also have the support of a squadron of fighter bombers based somewhere near Vinnytsia. "It seems we're getting ready for a big show," Fahim observed. "I don't like it." Oberst Fritelensen took the opposite view, rejoicing in our increased strength. As he saw it, the red tide must be stopped here. The idea that Prussia itself would soon fall into enemy hands never even crossed his mind. But then, that was true of all of us. One night, the Russians sent a human wave of Mongols in a direct assault against our positions. Their function was to knock out the minefield by crossing it. As the Russians preferred to economize on tanks, and as their human stockpile was enormous, they usually sent out men for jobs of this kind. The Soviet attack failed, but Stalin hadn't been looking for success. The minefield exploded under the howling mob, and we sent out a curtain of yellow and white fire to obliterate anyone who had survived. The fragmented cadavers froze very quickly, sparing us the stench which would otherwise have polluted the air over a vast area. The Russians had not even used any of their artillery to help the Mongols, which seemed to confirm our estimate of the situation. We sent out patrols to try to remine the field, but the Russians were ready to fire on anything that moved. We were able to put down only a light sprinkling of mines, with regrettably heavy losses. It was clearly no longer possible to rely on mines to protect our front lines. On another evening, when the cold had attained a dramatic intensity, the Russians attacked again. We were manning our positions in a temperature which had dropped to 45 degrees below zero. Some men fainted as the cold struck them, paralyzed before they even had a chance to scream. Survival seemed almost impossible. Our hands and faces were coated with engine grease, and when our worn gloves were pulled over this gluey mixture, every gesture became extremely difficult. Our tanks, whose engines would no longer start, swept the spaces in front of them with their long tubes, like elephants caught in a trap. The Muzaks preparing to attack us were suffering in the same way, freezing where they stood before there was time for even one arapobiba. The men on both sides, suffering a common martyrdom, were longing to call it quits. Metal broke with astonishing ease. The Soviet tanks were advancing blindly through the pale light of flares, which intensified the bluish glitter of the scene. These tanks were destroyed by the mines which lay parallel to our trenches some 30 yards from our front lines, or by our Tigers, which fired without moving. The Russian troops, with frozen hands and feet, faltered and withdrew in confusion in the face of the fire we kept steady, despite our tortured hands. Their officers, who had hoped to find us paralyzed by cold and incapable of defense, were unconcerned about the condition of their own troops. They were ready to make any sacrifice, so long as our lines were attacked. I managed to keep my hands from freezing by thrusting them, in their gloves, into two empty ammunition boxes, when the cartridges had run into the spandrel. Our gunners, and everyone forced to use his hands, sooner or later turned up at the medical service with severe cases of freezing. There were a great many amputations. The intense cold lasted for 3 weeks, during which the Russians restricted themselves to sending over music calculated to make us homesick, and speeches inviting us to surrender. Toward the end of January, the cold lessened somewhat, and became tolerable. At times during the day the thermometer rose as high as 5 degrees above zero. The nights were still murderous, but with frequent shifts of duty we managed to get through them. We knew that the Russian offensive would soon resume. One night, or rather one morning, toward 4 or 5 o'clock, blasts of the whistle sent us out once again to our interception posts. A mass of T-34 and Sherman tanks were moving forward in a loud roar. An artillery bombardment had preceded them, inflicting heavy damage on Boparovska, and provoking a mass evacuation by the civilian population, which had been waiting for the fighting in terrified apprehension. Our tanks, about 15 Tigers, 10 Panthers, and a dozen Mark IVs and 3s, had managed to start their engines, which had been heated continuously the day before. At the beginning of the offensive, 2 Mark IVs had been destroyed side by side in the Russian bombardment. The front was once again threatening to give way. We lay in our trenches, our eyes reduced to slits, waiting for the hordes of Red Infantry which would surely be coming soon. For the moment our machine guns and panzer forces were quiet, leaving the way clear for our heavy artillery and our tanks. Adroitly camouflaged, the Tigers lay waiting, with their engines idling. Almost every time a Russian tank came into range, a sharp, strident burst set it on fire. The Russians were moving toward us slowly, sure of themselves, firing at random. Their tactic of demoralization would have worked if there had not been so many plumes of black smoke rising against the pale February sky. Our 37s and Panzer Forsts, designed to be used at almost point-blank range, were scarcely called on. The first wave of Soviet armor was consumed 500 yards from our first positions, nailed down by the concentrated fire of our Tigers and Panthers and heavy anti-tank guns. The Tiger was an astonishing fortress. Enemy fire seemed to have almost no effect on its shell, which, at the front, was 5.5 inches thick. Its only weakness was its relative immobility. A second rush and wave followed closely after the first, more dense than the first, and accompanied by a swarm of infantry which posed a serious threat. We waited, dry-mouthed, our guns jammed against our shoulders and our grenades in easy reach. Our hearts were pounding. Suddenly, like a miracle, 30 of our planes flew over. As promised, the squadron from Vinnytsia was attacking. This particular job was easy for them, and every bomb hit home. A cry of "Sieg Heil, der Luftwaffe," rang so loudly from our trenches that the pilots might almost have heard it. We opened fire with everything we had, but the Russian offensive kept coming, despite overwhelming losses. Our tanks drove at the stricken enemy with an ardor worthy of 1941. The noise became unbearable. The air was thick with bitter fumes and smoke, and the smells of gunpowder and burned gasoline. Our shouts mingled with the shouts of the Russians, who were reeling under the unexpected resistance. We were able to watch the magnificent progress of our Tigers, pulverizing the enemy tanks before they were able to complete a half turn. The Luftwaffe attacked again with rockets and 20mm cannons. The Russian rout was hidden by a thick curtain of luminous smoke. The Russian artillery kept on firing at our lines, causing several deaths which we scarcely noticed. However, their guns were soon overrun by their own retreating troops, and fell silent. A second wave of German planes, an undreamed of extra luxury, completed the Russian debacle. We hugged each other in excitement, bursting with joy. For a year now, We had been retreating before an enemy whose numerical superiority was constantly increasing. Lenson was shouting like a man possessed by demons, "I told you we'd do it. I told you we'd do it." Our achievement was mentioned in special bulletins. The front on the Romanian border had held. After months of sustained attack and terrible cold, German and Romanian troops had once again pushed back the Russian offensive and destroyed quantities of enemy materiel. The mass of broken, twisted metal strewn with corpses which lay in front of us was visible proof of what we'd done. Along a front of 200 miles, the Red Army had launched 16 attacks inside of a month. Taking into account the 3 weeks of inactivity during which all operations were impossible, these 16 attacks had all occurred inside the space of 1 week. 5 points had borne the brunt of the Russian effort, and at only one had the Russians come close to success. The front was broken to the south, but this thrust was cut off, and the Russian troops were either annihilated or taken prisoner. In our sector all the lines had held, and we felt very proud. We had proved once again that with adequate material and a certain minimum preparation we could hold off an enemy of greatly superior size, whose frenzied efforts were never intelligently employed. The veteran, Wiener, had often remarked on this Russian failing at difficult moments. At the sight of an enemy tank in flames, he would bare his teeth in a wide, wolfish grin. "What a damned fool," he would say, "to let himself get caught like that. It's only their numbers that will get us, someday." There were 30 iron crosses for the Gross Deutschland, and as many for the small tank regiment, which also earned the honor. Returned to Poland, the division had been routed several times, and had sustained serious losses. Units believed to be intact were often borrowed from us, and sent to bolster some faltering position. When they arrived they would be found short by about two-thirds of their strength. There was nothing to be done about it. Our own group was enjoying a much-needed spell of relative calm. Our existence would have been almost idyllic except for the depressing and infuriating quality of barracks life. The exercises we were given, as if we were green troops in for basic training, brought us close to open revolt. We had moved 250 miles, to a position in Poland, far from the front. Our camp was on the banks of the Dniester, some 50 miles from Lwów, in the foothills of the Carpathians. The river is quite narrow at this point, and its waters, when we arrived, were swift and tumultuous, running through a network of small islands loaded with snow and ice. On any wide stretch the river was frozen to a considerable depth, and the current ran beneath the ice, giving off a strange, muffled noise. Our view was magnificent, a pale blue sky and a horizon marked by snow peaks, against which we could watch flights of eagles. For 2 months we enjoyed the agreeable change from the black and grey of a Ukrainian winter to the sportive landscape of eastern Galicia. Galician snows were also very heavy, and the cold was severe, but we slept in clean, heated barracks. Although an exaggerated sense of economy kept the heat at some 50 degrees or so, this at least enabled us to be fully alert when we were awake. Our camp was huge and organized with all the Prussian rigor of an army on the eve of battle. About 150 wooden buildings without floors had been built in blocks, carrying numbers and letters. Nearby, in the snow-covered woods, we could see a large stone building, which must have been part of the village beside the camp, and which housed our secretariat and principal officers. All our material had been repainted and overhauled. In these conditions of order and apparent abundance, none of us dreamed that Germany had reached the limit of its capacities. After the chaos of the front, the atmosphere of efficient organization, with its requirement that every move be registered in writing, made us feel like wild beasts suddenly caged. The camp was built around a large central square for reviews and drills, in which young recruits were instructed in the art of manipulating arms, so useful in parades and so useless at the front. The young recruits seemed to enjoy these exercises. Others, like Hals and me, were seeing ourselves as we had been a year and a half ago, back in Poland, where we had handled explosives for the first time. The memory of those days seemed at least 10 years old. One ages quickly in wartime. Our world-weary attitude did not escape the attention of the young recruits, who responded by holding themselves even more stiffly, as if to show us that the war was now their affair. This healthy enthusiasm of schoolboys, suddenly transformed into soldiers, was destined to weaken somewhat after a few nights in the mud and the shock of seeing a field hospital for the first time. We had been through all that. They would soon learn that war does not always create the same exaltation as the intoxicating explosion of the plaster grenades in the war games of training camp. The Führer, who was now scraping the bottom of the barrel, had been forced to send his arrogant Bleisei off to war. These elderly new recruits were having a hard time of it. The sight of policemen crawling through the mud on their bellies delighted us enough so that we almost forgot our sufferings. Police officers, whose competence in war was limited, handed over their men to officers of the Wehrmacht, who put them through the works. This spectacle, which gave us so much pleasure, was hard on the eager young recruits, directly exposed to the bad humor of those bastards who did everything they could to keep the younger men in a state of inferiority. For us, life was also very far from perfect. Before settling into our new quarters, there had been a long and difficult journey. We had begun by tramping more than 30 miles on bad Russian roads, deeply rutted and coated with ice. Then we were loaded onto trucks, and driven as far as Mogilev, an oriental-looking town, where we boarded two trains, both in very bad condition, for the remainder of the journey, along the Bessarabian frontier, to Lvov, in Poland. From Lvov, trucks had brought us to the camp, where we had stumbled out, exhausted and filthy, under the suspicious gaze of polished, healthy officer instructors. We were allowed 48 hours to rest, before our clothes and equipment had to be in perfect order. At our first inspection, the condition of our uniforms shocked the inspectors, although we had brushed and beaten them as hard as we could. They had completely lost their original color and appearance. Gray-green had become greenish-piss-yellow, decorated by tears and holes and reddish-brown burns. Our worn and crumpled boots had lost their black finish, and many were without heels or laces. We looked like a bunch of tramps, and the inspectors were ready to jump at the slightest sign of negligence. These evident traces of the battlefield struck them like slaps in the face, to which there was no answer. Those fops should, in fact, have been honoring us. They knew it too, and the knowledge irritated them. They persisted in picking on details to try to save face. A short way off, sections of police and students in camouflage uniforms were marching to their daily sweat baths, singing gaily in the dry, cold air, which had brought out the color in their cheeks. Das Sconst auf der Welt, first mein Tirolerland. However, instead of the Alps, the Carpathians witnessed their compulsory gaiety. The instructors, intent on inspection, were insensible to the poetry of the scene. One of them stopped short in front of a Jefreiter whose coat ended in a fringe as full of holes as a piece of Alencon lace. At last the Stabsfeldbull could unload a little rage in front of his sarcastic audience. Our heads turned slightly, scarcely noticeably, to the right, toward the fellow accused of negligence. We rolled our eyes as far as we could, trying to see who was getting it. "Name and number," shouted the Stabs, stiffening his neck. Even if we couldn't see anything, we could hear it. "Frosch, Herr Stabsfeldbull," the accused shouted, adding the number which each of us was supposed to know by heart. "Frosch." The name stirred an echo in my memory, "Frosch." And then the barracks the day after we crossed the Dnieper came back to me. Hot water, and a foolish-looking fellow of angelic goodwill. What was the Stabs going to pin on him? In the third row of men, some 10 or 12 yards from me, Frosch was standing at attention, while abuse rained down on him. He was staring straight ahead, as required by convention. His gaunt, hollow face was partly hidden by his heavy steel helmet. Unfortunately, his stupidity was obvious enough to give the Stabs a sudden sense of confident superiority over this soldier, who had clearly seen a lot. Two large hands, red with chilblains, emerged from his ragged sleeves to press for warmth against the folds of filthy cloth. The coat no longer had any buttons. Frosch had fastened it at each buttonhole with a short piece of wire. With a touching sense of aesthetics, he had bent in the ends of each wire, as if to demonstrate his good intentions. Unfortunately, he had linked a lower buttonhole to a higher one, which produced an improper and all too visible crease. This anomaly leapt to the eye of the inspecting non-com, who couldn't let such a golden opportunity slip. However, in complete disregard of normal practice, the company officer intervened, reminding the Stabsfeldbel that our detachment had just survived an extremely difficult experience. Your supplementary report specifically stated that you possessed the necessary materials for keeping your clothes in good repair, Herr Lieutenant, and specifically mentioned buttons. The lieutenant didn't know how to answer. In addition, Herr Lieutenant, Jeffrey Tafrosch hasn't even bothered to line up the buttonholes correctly. There was a moment of charged silence. The lieutenant threw Frosch a look of despairing compassion. Couldn't he have spared himself all this and deprived the instructor of this ludicrous opening? But the facts were as they were, and the lieutenant, despite all his goodwill, couldn't alter them. He resumed his former position with an impassive air. A wave of irritation seemed to run through the company. Still just Anden, the Fels shouted. In a flood of gratuitous invective, Frosch was given 20 days detention and a series of punitive fatigues. Without flinching, Frosch left his position to stand in the ranks of the guilty. He was the only one. The inspection was over. Quarter turn, left, left. Our companies went on to march around the camp. Frosch remained where he was, staring straight ahead. As the only man to be punished, he seemed a symbol of injustice, alone in his punishment as he had always been in life. He had found some comradeship in the Wehrmacht, but the exigencies of military life exacted a high price. 10 days later, when the rest of the unit drew new clothes, Frosch kept his rags. He had in truth become a symbol. He didn't know how to hate, and always wore his expression of touching stupidity and banal goodwill. Later the veteran said of him, "He's as humble as Diogenes. If he doesn't deserve victory, at least he deserves paradise." Section forward. On the ground. On your feet. Run. Forward. On the ground. On your feet, facing me. The hard, frozen ground scraped our hands and knees, and the sharp twigs of the leafless scrub finished off our threadbare uniforms. They had put us through a series of exercises with concussion bombs. We, who had faced the fire of Russian Katyushas, just laughed. Then we had made ourselves as flat as the Ukrainian soil. Now we lay propped on one elbow, half amused, half exasperated. Our attitude provoked torrents of abuse and a collective punishment for the whole company. We had to crawl along the entire perimeter of the camp. The ground, 3 or 4 inches beneath our eyes, soaked up the muttered curses of our progress. The instructor non-coms were working hard, running along the carpet of soldiers. A short way off, Wesrido was watching this bad joke and arguing with the officers responsible for the camp. But he might as well have saved his breath. Orders from higher up had put an end to the coddling of troops just back from the front. We had to reinstate the rigidity of 40-41, and wage war to the death. We went on long marches, carrying all our gear. We tramped through villages in step, singing. These demonstrations were intended to impress the local population, who, in fact, greeted us as we went by, the boys waving and the girls smiling. The routine never let up. We even had to practice retreating in a series of backward leaps, a skill which might always come in handy. Every fourth day, we were free from 5 to 10 p.m. We flooded into Novotarechi and Suika, two villages near the camp, where the peasants often invited us into their houses and gave us something to drink, and sometimes even to eat. Our soldiers quickly amused themselves with the girls, who were not shy. These few hours of liberty, used to the utmost, made us forget the rest. The following day we would return to the training routine. Despite the boredom, we cooperated, thinking that perhaps these were necessary measures. We were still inclined to believe in the validity of orders. Perhaps these exercises would help us bring the war to a quicker end. At last we were issued new clothes. Some of the uniforms were quite different from the ones we'd always known, with blouses like those worn in the French army today, and trousers tucked into short, thick spats, looking like a grotesque parody of a golf in costume. This new design was for the most part distributed to new troops. The Grossdeutschland, as an elite division, kept the old design. We were even given new boots, a further sign of privilege. However, the cloth of the uniforms was of very inferior quality, much more brittle than formerly. It reminded us of specially treated cardboard. The new boots were also markedly inferior, of rough, stiff, fourth quality leather, which cracked at the ankle instead of forming the usual creases. The underclothes were the worst of all. They were made of a cloth which seemed to have substance only where it was doubled at the hem and the seams. The new socks, which we appreciated immensely, also seemed curiously synthetic. "If this is what we're getting," Hals said, "I'll keep my Russian socks." In fact, the new socks wore a great deal longer than the old ones. However, they were less warm. They were among the first to be made with nylon, which was still largely unknown. We slapped a great deal of black polish from the store onto the boots, to make them lose their look of cardboard paste. We all felt better to be out of our stinking, tattered rags, and in new clothes, despite the synthetic fabrics. Our brightened appearance also had its effect on the local inhabitants, who decided that all must be well with the Wehrmacht. Hals, in his fresh and dashing uniform, had fallen in love once more, this time with a pretty young Polish girl. With him, falling in love was compulsive. He really couldn't help himself, and lost a piece of his heart every time we stopped in a rest zone. This time, as always, he was ardently wooing a girl during our short periods of free time, and we all had to hear about it constantly. "You're driving us all up the wall with your tart," Lenson complained. "Why can't you just kiss and run like everybody else?" Lindbergh grinned. He was remembering his last outing with Lenson, Fahim, and Solmer. The four of them had trapped a Polish woman of about 40 in a barn. She had yielded to their ardor, which had lasted the 4 hours remaining. "Her husband came home while we were at it," Solmer remembered joyfully. "He laughed with us, and said, 'Mama too old for me now for you.'" Later they'd all had a drink with the husband, who seemed perfectly content that they'd done him that service. "She's nothing but a sow, you're Polska," Hals said. "And you're just a bunch of pigs. No poetry at all." The barracks shook with our laughter. Pastor Fahim laughed too, because he couldn't do anything else, but all the same he was somewhat troubled. Our company's love life was doing far too well. I myself didn't have any particular adventures. I had poured one or two girls, but matters had never progressed any further than that. Of course, I was in love with Paula and wrote to her often. Above all, I longed for a leave, and lived on that hope. For the rest, strange bodies made me uneasy, almost sick. As soon as I saw naked flesh, I braced myself for a torrent of entrails, remembering countless wartime scenes, with smoking, stinking corpses pouring out their vitals. All things considered, I preferred platonic love by mail. To me, Paula was in an entirely separate category from all these other women, something delicate and marvelous, which could not be eviscerated, or so I tried to think. Then I was involved in an episode which gave everyone else a laugh at my expense. We were on leave at Sueca. It was a beautiful day, with only a light trace of frost. We all felt like a spree, but were also extremely interested in food. Our rations were now so small that we were always hungry when we left the mess halls. The peasants would usually sell us something to eat in exchange for the paper currency, which looked as though the Renton Bank was printing notes in excess of its reserves. We had, in fact, been given these notes as supplementary pay, in addition to the special tickets issued to occupation troops. Eggs were the easiest form of food to come by. At Sueca we divided the job. There were three of us, Hoff, Schlosser, and me. We had left Hals with his Polska at Nevotrechy. Nevotrechy was right beside the camp, and the soldiers had already stripped it of all extra food.